Here we are, again, some of us. Who's here has never been in any of these sessions? Anybody? Okay, I'm sorry, I can't recapitulate the whole thing for you, but you didn't miss anything. I mean, if nothing essential, you know, you can still understand what we're doing today, but you haven't a clue about the rest of it. It's okay, it doesn't matter. Well, this is... I forgot now what we're going to start with. Oh, I know. We're going to actually start with some ragtime again, as we've been doing. And usually we have more people to do this clapping exercise. Some of you have done this before. One of the main points that I make is that the rhythm is at the basis of everything that we do here. American music is more to it than that, but boy, that rhythm is the most essential thing. And it goes right back to the earliest kinds of popular music, and it was ragtime, the earliest American, the first major hit, big-selling composition, you can't say recording because they weren't doing that, it was sheet music, was Maple Leaf Rag, 1899. It was African-American composer Scott Joplin. It came out in 1899 and sold lots of copies and made money. And that was, I think, the beginning of the American popular music. Anyway, based on rhythm, anyway, just to loosen myself up as much as anybody else, I want to do this clapping thing that we were doing, I guess in the first session, or something. Maybe we've done it more than once, I don't remember. But we're going to do it again anyway. And we're going to count to four, and it's very simple. But then I sit down and play the piano, and let's see if that would... See if that sounds like an orchestra or a band or something. Well, if I play while you're doing this. But first, let's just start with the four beats. And that is one, two, three, four. 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 Okay. See, that's easy. But now, let's get divide up into sections here. And I think what we'll do is take the middle, because there might be just a little bit fewer people in the middle, so I'll give you the easy part. It doesn't have to be as loud or something. And that's the four that we just did. And we have a tendency, I'm afraid, to put the accents on the wrong beat, unless we come from New Orleans or someplace, and grow up with music that puts accents on the right beats, which are two and four, not one and three, when you count four. And it never fails. When you play for an audience and you try to get them to clap along on beats two and four, at least most of the time, maybe not in New Orleans quite as often or some other places, but if I stop helping them clap on two and four, they're going to go to one and three. So I just can't help it. Whoopi John influence or something. Anyway, so you guys are going to do the four, and over here I'm going to have you clapping on two and four. So you're going to count one, two, three, four. You got the easy part. And we'll start that. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Okay, keep that going. You guys are going to do this. Two, four. Two, four. Two, four. Two, four. Keep going in. We should hit the road, I think. Get out there and do some tour dates. you'd be a good influence on some of these audiences I've been talking about. That kind of loosens things up a little bit. I think if we kept going long enough, though, some people would start to lose it. We can't help it. That's the way we grow up. And it's unfortunate, but it's true. I'm going to play some things that I haven't played in the other sessions. It might be a little repetition, but not a whole lot today. But that have a lot of similarity to what we've been doing. So here's a New Orleans jazz piece, very early New Orleans jazz, by Jelly Roll Morton, who was born down there in 1890. And he wrote some very interesting pieces, including this one, which has all the ingredients in it that you said you were supposed to, he said that you needed to have to play jazz, and that included blues, ragtime, grand opera, Latin American rhythm, not necessarily all the time, but it's got to be in there someplace, and a whole lot of other things you heard as he was growing up. And all of it is in here, believe me, although I'm not going to stop and point it out as I play through it. And it's called The Original Jelly Roll Blues. It was published, he published it in 1915 in Chicago, and the subtitle on the sheet music, this will give you a clue as to his personality, Original Jelly Roll Blues, full of originality. You heard all those elements that you were ticking them off, but anyway, they were there. And that does sound a lot like ragtime. It's got keeping the tempo, the beat, the rhythm, that steady rhythm with the left hand. And so at least ideally, you're accenting the right beats, which is what we were working on with the clapping. And in the right hand is playing things against that kind of reinforce it, but at the same time, you're not playing right on all those beats, which we talked about yesterday in syncopation. Here's a blues that, just to show you that he didn't only write music. Here's a tune he played when he was recording for the Library of Congress. They did they had a folklore project going there in 1938, and Alan Lomax was there working for the WPA at the time, interviewing musicians. His gig was to go out and find people that he thought might have something to say and could play. The music would be documented. The sound would be documented there at the Library of Congress. Morton surprised him by having so much to say that it took him over a month to do it all, and he had to come back a few months later and finish it. And one of the things he played was this. It's called Mamie's Blues. One more reference to Jelly Roll Morton here, and then we'll move on to something else. This is one of his Latin American style tunes. I played one of them in the first session. He had a few of them, so this is a different one. And this, as I mentioned, he talked about this. He had Haitian ancestors too, as I mentioned in another session. So and New Orleans is like that. It's just one. It's a different kind of place entirely, not like any other place in this country. Certainly, it's more like a Caribbean city or something. So he did some of these compositions. He said, I really liked this kind of music when I was growing up. This would be around 1900, 1905 or something. So I liked it a lot, but I didn't like any of the tunes. So I had to write some of my own. That's a distinction. style versus tune. Anyway, this one is called Creepy Feeling, and it's nothing personal, it just, that is the name of it. Here it is. Now and gonna head to New York. We've been talking about some New York musicians also previous sessions, if you were around, you remember we did that with Fats Waller and James P. Johnson, and another East Coast guy, not from New York, but kind of the same part of the country, who spent a lot of his career in New York. That was U.B. Blake, who came from Baltimore. And there's one other guy I should mention, because he was extremely influential. You know, nowhere near as famous as Fats Waller was in his time, but influenced a lot of people like George Gershwin and Duke Ellington and others. And his name was Willie the Lion Smith, and they called him the Lion. He had his own way of playing the piano. It's not like anyone else, and he's influenced all these important people who never stopped singing his praises, but he wasn't making the money they were. Not that Ellington himself wasn't a genius, or Gershwin too, of course. But the Lion just, all he could do was play. He was in the background, but he's influenced everyone, including me. I got nothing to do with those greats of the old days, but he's still very influential, if you like, on traditional jazz piano. He had his own way of composing and playing, and this was kind of a signature piece of his called Echo of Spring.
Thank you.
But now that they're leaving, we can start doing something good. They're going to a staff meeting, they said. Anyway, another piece by The Lion, and this is pretty characteristic of his style as well, but nothing like this at all. And here it is, it's called Concentrating. His big admirers, Willie the Lion Smith, was Ellington, and he actually, Duke Ellington is probably a name that at least everybody knows, right? And he came from Washington, D.C., and he was born there in 1899, the same year Maple Leaf Rag was published, in fact, if that makes any difference. And Ellington had a very artistic soul. He grew up in a family that was actually doing okay. He was not from a poor neighborhood or anything like that. He showed signs of being some kind of an artist, visual artist, maybe a painter or something. He was talented in that direction. He also had a real aptitude for music, and at some point got fascinated with piano rolls. Anybody here has never seen a player piano? Yes, or there. Anyway, this is a mechanical contrivance. Basically, your piano would play itself, and all you had to do is pump some pedals down at the bottom. And some of the artists that we've been talking about had been making rolls, and these were sold to people who had these machines in their houses. And a lot of people did, including the Ellington family there. So he learned to play some pieces by these New York piano players we've been talking about, especially James P. Johnson, by just working the pedals and watching the keys go up and down to see exactly what the guy was doing. That's pretty good, you know. You can see what's being played, but that's not the what, it's not the how. He that was one of the early influences on him. But I said something too about his talent for the visual arts. I don't know, I think it's all one thing, because his music was certainly based on some principles that sound like it could be painting as well. It's like textures and combinations of things, contrast, and I know he thought of it that way. He's talked about music that way. Anyway, he went to New York when he was pretty young, and he had a band there, and he met some of these guys, including Willie the Lion, personally, and got to know them and made friends with them, and continued to be influenced by him. Meanwhile, he was going off in his own direction, but in 1928, he was already a fairly prolific recording artist, and he'd been doing pretty well as a band leader, too, playing some of the major venues in New York and recording already like crazy. So, he wasn't quite 30 years old. And he made a couple of piano solos. I'm going to play one of them here. It's not exactly the way Duke played it, but you can tell from this that he was this kind of a piano player, at least early on, kind of similar to what we've been doing here. And this one was called Black Beauty, and it was a tribute to a dancer and performer named Florence Mills. Don't have time to give you her biography, but that's the title. So he was thinking of her when he wrote this, Black Beauty.
Thank you.
a foreshortened, we're going to run out of time, I want to get more stuff in, but that was kind of a couple of sections at least of another piece that Duke Ellington recorded in 1928 at the same recording session. Those were his first recorded piano solos, and even by that time, I think he was thinking of himself not as a piano player, but as a guy whose instrument was his band, and that's something that is pretty hard to do on a piano. He worked in clubs like the Cotton Club. That was a big deal for him. He got the job there, a place up in Harlem where the audience was white, but the proprietor, and well, not the proprietor, he was white too, but the performers and everybody who worked there were black, and it was an exotic thing for these people who wanted to go out in the middle of the night and see a show, all kinds of wonderful girls dancing and terrific stuff. I wish I could have been there myself to see it. And Ellington wrote some extremely exotic music. And I haven't got a band, and I don't want to try to play the whole thing, but this was one of them. I'll just play a piece of it so you get an idea. In case you've never heard Duke Ellington's band before, I hardly believe it, but I know it's true. Some people haven't. This was something that he was playing. The other thing about Duke is that he would write something for the band and then keep playing it throughout his whole career, which lasted pretty much until he died in 1974. And he'd keep playing this in the band would evolve, and he would, so would the music, he'd rewrite sections of things and modify and change and work on the stuff all the time. Everything was a work in progress, which is pretty much what this music is about. But he was a guy who did it with this whole orchestra, kept him on a payroll for all that time just so he could have an instrument. It was phenomenal. So this is kind of the early, the way it sounded, just a suggestion of it. But it was a piece that he continued to play throughout the rest of his career, but he first started recording in the 20s, called The Mooch. Play in the concert, but that would be with the clarinet and stuff. It is this one, in case you didn't hear it this morning. I had a session this morning as well. It's called Moon Indigo, and it's an interesting tune. Just one little thing about it was that it's recorded with a smaller band, and he had, I don't know if you guys know anything about Dixieland or anything, but he had a sort of a lineup like a Dixieland band with a horns or a clarinet, trombone and trumpet. And you think about the clarinet, you think, okay, the clarinet is going to be playing higher than the trombonist. And the trombonist certainly will be the lowest. Nope. Duke decided to put the clarinet right on the bottom. I'll talk a little more about that, but not tonight. You should come to the concert. Anybody here is not going to be here Friday night, though? Okay. Give me your address. I'll send you a postcard about it. All right. But yeah, the interesting thing was, and I heard this when I was a kid, my dad had this recording, and it really sounded weird. These guys were also recording in the late 20s, 1930, and recording technology was not really very far along at that time, but they've got right up tight on the microphones with the two brass instruments and the clarinet, and played very quietly. Really tight kind of mutes in the brass. And it sounded so eerie. So all I can do is give you a little suggestion of it, and so I will.
Here's the clarinet. Trombone is way up there. That's pretty high for trombone, especially in those days. Jazz guys get much higher than that now, but... sound of the instruments, but it's still pretty exotic.
Very faint suggestion of what it was really all about. Let's see, what was I going to say? One other thing about Ellington, but I can't remember what it was, so I won't. Maybe I wrote it down. Nope. That's okay. I have one other person to talk to you about, and also one track to play for you as a recording. So I'll get to that. And in fact, it's probably a good thing I'm not going to do anymore. This person is Big Spiderbeck. Not an African American. He's a white kid from Davenport, Iowa. But he heard these African American guys playing jazz when he was just a kid. Because they were coming up the river and coming right through there, and on the river boats, that's the kind of music they played on those boats. It's hard to say exactly when he first heard anything like this. He was born in 1903, and there was plenty of jazz on those boats by the time he was a teenager. So that's why he became a jazz musician. And he was a fabulous musician, extremely influential, and the fact that the music was so powerful that it could grab this German kid from Davenport and pretty much take him for a lifelong ride, and he really wasn't good for much else. All he wanted to do was play music. That's what went through his mind all the time. So I'm just going to play a quick piece that he wrote for piano. He also played some piano, but mostly cornet. He loved these exotic harmonies and things. So I don't know why, but when I was thinking about Ellington, I thought, well, we might as well put a Bix piece in here too. I guess because Duke liked colors. And he would search for these things. He'd sit at the piano instead of leaving the stand during a break sometimes at a dance or something. The other guys would be running for the bar and outside and who knows what, but he would sit down and just keep playing at the piano, searching for things. So here's this piece. Thank you. in the dark, and I think it just really conveys the Beyerbecke personality. It sounds kind of like, you know, he was fascinated with modern classical music of his time, Debussy and all those kind of people. So that was part of it. Anyway, we got to move along, and we don't want to bump into the Vespers service. So I think I should play the track on the CD just after I talk about it. It's track 5. I'll do that in just a second. But first I want to encourage you to come to this video documentary tonight at 8:30. It's next door. And it's about Mahalia Jackson, the great gospel singer, world's greatest gospel singer, and she was billed. She was from New Orleans, and some of you must know this. Sure you do. And an incredible performance. She's on this. It's a Duke Ellington recording, but it's he liked to, you know, keep the ideas open for his palate. Mahalia Jackson, he recognized the power of her voice, and he used her for a recording session. It's in the 50s, but let me just tell you exactly when it was. I feel better that way. And I've got it here. It's a composition of Duke's called Black, Brown, and Beige. And it's pretty much, as he said, supposed to be the story of my race. It's just sweet, and there were several movements, one of which is a real kind of spiritual. It's called Come Sunday. In this recording session, 1958, the piece by then was, 15 years old, maybe a little more. But it had been modified greatly on this occasion for this classy recording session. He decided to bring in the great Mahalia Jackson as one of the instruments. And so this performance by Duke Ellington and Mahalia Jackson is from 1958. She doesn't do this in the documentary. That's all. The documentary's great. It's all about a European tour that she was on not long before she died. It was around 1970, the tour. And you just aren't going to believe the music, but also just the way it was, the hysteria, the crowds, they just were going absolutely insane. Flowers flying up on the stage. And it really is unbelievable. But so here she is, though, in 1958. In this context, the Duke Ellington Orchestra, and it's called Come Sunday.
God Almighty, God. Yesterday.
always gets me. And the music in the film is not nothing like that, really. Not that that should put you off or anything. I just can't say, that record really gets me. But what she has in there in the film is pretty much a pianist and an organist, and nothing more. But boy, they got so much, they pump out so much music, it's unbelievable. That's at 8:30. Thank you very much, and I'll see you guys tomorrow, perhaps, if you're happy.